Hi, my name is Maria Hamlin Zuniga, and I am living in Central America. I've lived there for the past 25 years, working in health education and doing public health. Originally, I'm from Minnesota. Some of you are too, aren't you? Nobody in this room from Minnesota?
Original.
Well, why don't we start this evening by having you tell me something about why you came to this session. Why did you come this evening to this session? What are your expectations? Anybody? Feel free.
I came because I took a trip to Central America about 7 years ago now, and through the Center for Global Education out of Minneapolis, and we went to Nicaragua and El Salvador, and I was interested in hearing more about just what was happening with health education and how, you know, if you were going to talk about a specific program tonight, to hear about that, but also to hear about just how things have changed, not changed, with the recent developments in the country, what kind of emphasis and support there still is or isn't for some of the health initiatives that have been made.
Okay, anybody else? Anybody else? Feel free to say anything.
I went to one of your earlier sessions and was interested in how you, actually some of the details on how you implemented some of the things you talked about before.
Okay. Uh-huh. In the back there?
Me? I'm a home care nurse and I do a lot of health education in the home. So I
just
like to see.
Oh, okay. How come you came here tonight?
Well, my degree is in child and youth care, and I eventually want to work in hospitals, and so working with hospitalized kids is my focus, so I just wanted to hear what you think.
Anybody else want to say something?
I think we assume in this country that we have the way to do things from health education, healthcare standpoint, and I think we can learn a lot from many other countries. And the child seemed like an idea that I'd like to know more about as it relates to there, but what about here?
Mm-hmm. Very good. I think that's what I would like to get out of this session as well. Share with you a little bit about what this is all about when we're talking about from the perspective of a third world country, but ask you how you think that this could be applied here in the United States. Child to child . What do you think that might mean? Anybody have an idea why we say child to child? No?
Could mean one child to another, but it could also mean children having children.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
well,
or
it
peer,
does mean
peer learning.
One to another. In 1979 was the International Year of the Child. And there were a number of health professionals from around the world, from different countries like the United States, England, people who had worked in Latin America, in Africa, and in Asia. And these people came together and they discussed what could be done in the International Year of the Child that would be helpful to children, but would help to raise awareness among adults of the situation of children in many, many countries of the world. In most developing countries, we have a population pyramid that children from zero or from birth to 15 years make up about 50% of the population. This is true in almost all of the developing countries of the world. We don't have that kind of population pyramid in the United States. In the United States, increasingly, there are more and more older people. But in the developing countries, this is our situation. And even when we have high mortality rates in these poor countries, we still have a population pyramid that's pretty heavy on this level. So this means that the mothers of these children often have to work. Many of these children come from single-parent families. That does not mean that they don't have fathers. Of course they have fathers, and perhaps the fathers are even present. But many, many of the children are children who belong to serial relationships. In other words, a young woman has a baby, maybe at 14, 15 years old. She is in love with her, with the father of this child, they think, you know, the young think that. Then, as the baby begins to grow, the young man can't, he's young, he can't raise a family, and so he sort of disappears. He leaves the picture. There she is, usually with her mother, and her mother ends up taking care of a 15, 16-year-old plus her baby. And then this continues to happen. So a lot of the mothers are working mothers. And a lot of the grandmothers are working mothers as well. And in poor countries, this may mean that they work in the fields, if they're in rural areas. It may be they do domestic work in homes. It may be that they work in factories. But what happens is the mother is not present. And perhaps the grandmother is not present. And we have a situation where older children, and by older children I mean children maybe between 10 and 13 years of age, are taking care of their younger siblings. And so these health people who met in England to discuss what could be done for the International Year of the Child decided that perhaps an interesting thing to do would be develop programs for children in this age group, or even up to 15 years of age. You know? Because these are the caretakers in many, many homes, these could be the real health promoters in the home. By health promoters, we mean people who are promoting safety and health and information to their families or to other people. When we were talking about other health promoters last night, we discussed a little bit about health promotion. So the idea was to develop a philosophy around child to child, and develop the child-to-child philosophy with an approach for working with families and working with communities. And these different workers, these different health professionals, went off to their different parts of the world, and they developed what we call the child-to-child methodology. And they worked, they experimented with activities with children who were in this age group. They worked with teachers, they worked with other health workers, but basically training them to work with children. Now, one of the things that happens to us is we become professional people, and if we're not professional teachers in preschool or in primary school, we lose the language. We lose our ability to talk with children and deal with children as our equals. We develop our own jargon in our professions, and especially health professionals tend to do this. I guess others do too, but you know, those of us who are health workers know what a jargon we have around our professions. And so, how do you develop activities so that you can work with children to help them understand the messages that we want to get across? Well, I'm going to give you some very practical examples. During that year of 1979, this program was developed with people from different parts of the world, and then some of us who were working in countries, developing countries around the world, began to apply this methodology to our work. And the first thing that we had to do was convince older people, these teachers and health professionals, that it was important to work with this age group. So that meant that we had to really have much more information about what was happening in homes. And all we have to do is visit marginal communities. And I don't think that we would have to even go very far from here to find families where older children are caring for younger children. No? And so we did this kind of investigation in the communities that we were working. And we not only found out how many children there were that were in this situation, but we also discovered what were the kinds of things that kids were running into in the home. Well, can you think of some things that you might find, some health problems that you might find in homes where children take care of children? Have you had any ideas?
It's basic sanitation.
Basic sanitation? Mm-hmm. What else?
Accidents.
That's actually the first thing. There are lots of accidents in the home. Anything else?
Nutrition.
Why do you say that?
Why?
Uh-huh.
Because children, given a choice, will often eat things that aren't healthy for them, and they'll give them to their baby sisters and brothers.
In the case of poverty, maybe they don't even have something to eat.
Oh, sure. Right. And if you're on food stamps, it's more likely that you're going to have unhealthy foods than healthy in your house.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so different activities were developed around these kinds of problems. Well, the number one problem that we have around the world in third world countries, up to very recently, up to this last year as a matter of fact, was death from diarrhea, death from dehydration related to diarrhea. That was the number one cause of death just up to last year. Now, because of a lot of work that has been done in developing countries around the prevention and treatment of diarrhea, we now have a situation where upper respiratory infections are becoming the number one cause of death. Do you find that in your populations? You?
Yeah. Yes, I think that's true.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. It's just in the last, it was like in April or May when the director of UNICEF came out saying this for the first time, that now upper respiratory infections are getting the upper hand, if you will, in poor families and poor communities. Now, if diarrhea is the number one cause of death, one of the first things that we decided to work on was how we could teach little children about diarrhea. Well, they know what diarrhea is, because it's something that's very common in situations of poverty and situations of poor sanitation. And so working with children to help them then know what it is that they would have to do when a young child, a younger sibling, a child between, you know, maybe 6 months, a year, 2 years, develops diarrhea and the mother isn't in the home. Can any of you tell me what should be done? What is the first thing that should be done in the case of diarrhea? Remember, you're not going to take them to a health center. There's not one nearby.
You haven't got any medicine in you?
No.
Because I know there's something you can take to stop diarrhea. Some kind of liquid, I think it was.
What happens when we have diarrhea?
Dehydration.
What happens is the same thing that happens when Elizabeth cuts the flowers and doesn't put them in water. What happens to the flowers when you don't put them in water?
It looks sad.
And actually, I got so involved in my conversation that I didn't get over here and do that, but I was going to put up for you the flowers here. These flowers are healthy. When did you cut these, Mom?
This afternoon.
This afternoon. She cut these this afternoon, but you still see them up there bright and pretty to look at. But if she hadn't put any water in there, you would see them wilting. And so one of the activities that we do with children is show them the difference between what has water and what doesn't have water. And we use flowers or plants. And then we talk with them and we help the children to understand that the first thing that we have to do when there's diarrhea is to make sure that we rehydrate that child, that we give that child water. And is it any water that we give the child? Well, we'll look at that. What should the water have in it? What do our body fluids have in them?
Electrolytes.
They have, we call them electrolytes in the medical field, right? But what is it really?
It's salt.
It's salt. Salts and sugars and so on. And so when you cry, what are your tears like? Or don't you cry? They're salty. We know that tears are salty. We know that blood is salty, right? Well, what we have to do is prepare a solution that has more or less the amount of salt that our tears do or that our blood does. And so we teach the children how they can make a rehydrating fluid. Now, in fancy terms, you call this oral rehydration therapy, ORT. Well, we don't call it ORT, because what's ORT to a kid, right? But we call it a special drink. In different languages, they use different things. But what we talk about, a special drink, a special refresco, in the case of Nicaragua, that will help rehydrate children. And so it's a mixture of sugar, of water, sugar, and salt. Now, you said boiled water. Well, boiled water would be ideal. It would be the best thing. But we're trying to save a life. Mm-hmm. And boiling water in a lot of communities means making use of wood and taking the time. And when children have diarrhea, we don't have time to take time. We need to rehydrate them. So those of us who are less conventional, let's say, would say, don't worry about boiling the water, but worry about getting fluids into the kid. We'll worry about the rest of it later. No? Because we want to save the life. In severe diarrhea, in typhoid, for example, we have seen children die within 4 to 6 hours if they're not cared for. A lot of diarrhea isn't that serious, but in a small child, when they lose water, they lose it much faster because there's less volume. You know, we get dehydrated and we just know we're thirsty and we start drinking. Carol was talking about the importance of not becoming dehydrated on trips up into the hills, into the mountains, right? Somebody heard her say that today or yesterday? We have a hiker here, just came in. I bet he knows the importance of having plenty of water along. And so what happens, we adults can have more tolerance than little babies do. And so because their volume their is much less than ours, they will die sooner. And they will become severely dehydrated sooner. So the kids learn how to make the rehydration fluid, and they learn how to give it. Now, somebody mentioned medicine. One of the most important things that we teach people about diarrhea is that you don't need to give medicines initially. Because about 70% of the diarrheas that we have in most of the developing world are viral. And they will not respond to antibiotics. Right, Doc? They won't respond. And so a lot of this diarrhea medicine and giving antibiotics for diarrhea is not really what's indicated. Now here in this country, you can go ahead and do lab exams and find out. You know? But we're talking about how to respond rapidly to the situation to be able to save lives. Later on, if the diarrhea continues, we would know we would have to go and look for a doctor. But a viral diarrhea treated properly with oral rehydration fluid will take care of itself.
To what extent is the water itself the problem initially, and then how does that enter?
Yes, water is certainly a problem. And were you here at last meeting?
No,
one of the things that we try to work on is the importance of potable water systems. Of course, we could put potable water systems in practically all the communities of the world with the money that's spent on the old Star Wars or on missiles that we're sending out, you know. But that's not the priority in this world, is putting in water systems, unfortunately. One of the things that we do with the kids then is precisely that. We teach them, we work with them, so that they know how to respond in the case of the diarrhea and what to do in their homes. But we also work with the kids on the importance of looking for the causes of illness within the communities. No? Mm-hmm. And so children learn what they can do to identify what is going on with the health of their communities. And so one of the first things that the kids do is a community diagnosis. Because we're talking about kids that are in schools or are in some community activity together. These are the kinds of kids that we would be working with. Teachers help them, but mostly we try to find an older child, maybe a 15-year-old, who's interested in being a promoter of this particular approach to work. And these young people then work with the youngsters, and together they plan a community diagnosis, because that's the first most important thing that we have to do in our public health work. Isn't that right? Mm-hmm. We have to know what's going on in our community, because in the case of public health, our patient is not the individual patient that a private doctor or the hospitals will necessarily be seeing. In the case of a public health worker, our patient is the community, and we have to know and understand that community. We have to do a community history. And so the kids map out their community. And this can be done in a rural community, it can be done in an urban setting, in the neighborhood where the kids work and live. And they try to find out what are the sources of water. What are the sources, where do we take care of our waste disposal? Well, in most places, they don't have a garbology team. They really need a garbology team in some of these countries, but they don't have them, right? So we find where the garbage is deposited, where human waste are deposited. In many poor communities, both urban and rural, there's not proper waste disposal. And so you do have contaminated water sources. Well, the kids learn this. They learn to identify the sources and the problems related to those sources. If they have potable water, at the source of the water, is it still clean and safe when it gets to their houses if they have to carry the water? And remember, in the vast majority of communities in this world, people don't have running water in their homes. I've lived now for 25 years in Central America, and I feel privileged at the present time because I live in a city and I have water and I have lights. And for many years I lived without those. I lived with a creek going by, and that was my water source for a long, long time. And when I lived in Guatemala, we had water only 1 hour a day, a certain hour, because we had an earthquake and the water system was destroyed, and we had very limited water. We had no electricity. And so one has to learn to live with this, and it's a good way to learn how to work in a poor country, is having to live in the situation that poor people live in, no? Like I say, now I feel privileged because I have water and I have lights. But helping children then understand and work with the situation. And what do you think happens when kids start doing this community diagnosis? What do you think starts happening? What happens in their homes?
Well, they would tell their parents.
Uh-huh.
And their parents hopefully would take concern and do something to change it. The communities, the small communities would tend to work together, especially if a number of the children are going to the parents, and those parents are meeting together and discussing it.
Mm-hmm. You engage more people in the luchar or whatever.
In the lucha. Yeah. That's what happens. First of all, you know, the mother may come home and she'll say, what is it that you're doing with this kid? And then the child will explain how they've learned this in the school. And maybe there will be rejection at first, because as adults, a lot of us don't want our kids telling us what to do, right? Well, poor people are the same as most other people in that sense. No? We adults seem to think we know everything, and the kids don't. But the kids do have something to offer. And gradually, because of the way the methodology works, the parents begin to have much more interest in what their kids are doing in the home. They see the difference, and they begin to accept some of the learning and the sharing that children do with them. Well, we have a situation in one of the communities where we work, where a child-to-child program was begun. The kids did the community diagnosis. They discovered there were no latrines in this. It was a cooperative. It had been a former coffee plantation that was turned over to the workers in northern Nicaragua. And there was a school set up there with teachers who were from the community. And this idea of child-to-child was introduced to these teachers, and they picked up on it right away. And so they began working together, and they did the community diagnosis, and of course they discovered that the source of water was the river, or up at the main part of the plantation, and that there were no latrines. And so they mapped out their community, and they began to discuss this, and every day they would come and they would add more things to their maps. You know? They discovered more things about the communities. Well, we have a map of the community when the program began, and we have a map of the community today. And today there are latrines. Some are shared between two or three homes, and some are individual latrines. But people have latrines, and they've learned how to use them, and hopefully to use them properly. They also have learned that they need safer sources of water, but they have certain limitations. And so because they have these limitations, they have to know how to take care of the water. And it's the kids that have been teaching this sort of thing. No? It's a really kind of exciting thing to watch. Now,
so what do they do to take care of the water?
They may have to boil it. No, but know when they should boil it, and how to boil at the same time that you're cooking other foods. And then the idea of having a estufa de Lorena. An estufa de Lorena is a kind of mud stove that uses very little wood. In fact, it's made out of Lorena is a combination of mud and sand. And it's fixed up in such a way, I really can't draw, so I don't know how I could make you understand this. To the top of the stove, there are holes that go down in and under here. No, it's not. Well, anyway, in the side, it has this place where you put the fire in. It looks sort of like a...
a rural mailbox?
A kiln?
An oven, the kinds of ovens that they have in the Southwest. You know,
adobe.
At the end, the adobe ovens. And they put the a little bit of wood, or they put in... corn husks or whatever, and you can start a fire and it preserves the heat, and so they cook several things at a time. So some people have introduced this kind of stove into the community so that you can boil your water while you're doing the rest of the cooking, right? Well, anyway, they know that it's important in some cases to boil water, that in other cases, because you're using your cooking, you don't have to boil the water that you're cooking with, you know. So, and how to protect the water sources. Well, one of the major protections of the water sources is to have a latrine. Now, another thing that's happened is helping children become aware of the difficulties that other children might have, and identifying certain kinds of disabilities. And so this methodology has been used to help children identify problems of sight or problems with hearing by playing games. You know? And they play games where they tell secrets around a group. You know? And then they listen to the words that come out and to see if the words that were said in the game are the words that the person said to the child, you know? And then they can tell if somebody hears. Well, that's explaining it very quickly. And they learn games for different kinds of disabilities. They learn how to do testing in the schools or in their groups for sight, using those kinds of old-fashioned letters that have been used for a long time in identifying these kinds of problems. But not only do they learn to recognize the disabilities and to find ways to refer them on, they also learn, and I think this is really important, that some of us may have one kind of disability and somebody else may have another kind of disability, but all of us have abilities. No? And one of the ways to help children understand that is to have them pretend that they have only one leg, or that they have to walk with crutches, or that they can't see. We have a blind child here in the village this week, don't we? No. And that the persons who have one kind of disability may develop other capacities more than we can. And so the idea is not just to identify and do something about these disabilities, but help people to understand, help children to understand, and accept other children and recognize the abilities that all of us have. And I think this is a really nice part of the work that's being done. Now I'm going to tell you specifically what we're doing right now in Nicaragua. One of the things that was an expectation is to learn a little bit about more about what's happening in hell. Well, in Nicaragua, since the election of the new government, we have a situation whereby there's an application of what is called structural adjustment programs to all of the social services in Nicaragua. And whereby at one time we had about 12-15% of the national budget being spent on health and health-related programs in Nicaragua. Now we have only about 2-3% of the national budget being spent. And so most of the very progressive kinds of programs that we had in the past are being cut out. And this is true in health, it's true in education, and in social services. So what this means, come down to it, is that where we had, at one time, about one-third of the entire population of Nicaragua studying in some kind of school, whether it was preschool, primary, secondary, university level, today, most of those institutions have been cut way back. In fact, there's a strike going on right now in the whole university system in Nicaragua. It's been going on now for about 3 weeks, where all of the teachers, the students, and the people who work as administrative kind of personnel are striking for the 6% of the national budget that is supposed to be guaranteed for the university systems. What's happening at the secondary and primary level? Well, what's happening there is with the application of the structural adjustment programs, teachers have been removed from their jobs. And so we have many fewer teachers now than we had, say, 2 or 3 years ago, because the idea is to reduce the budget by reducing the number of teachers. Well, if you reduce the number of teachers, obviously you're reducing the possibility of children to go to school. So we have fewer children able to go to school, and we have a situation where, in order to go to school, there are costs which the parents have to somehow meet for books, for tuition, for other things. In a country where for 10 years people felt that education was their right, you know, that it's your right to be able to go to school and to have an education, and the government paid, made available to people, teachers and schools and materials and so on. Now when I say that to some people, they say, well, everywhere people have to pay to go to school. No. You pay your taxes. Well, in Nicaragua, there are people who pay taxes, but the disposition of the government was that this was a right and everybody should have it whether they could pay for it or not. That's not true anymore. So we have a situation where a lot of kids are out on the streets and a lot of kids are working. Kids that, and they're working in what is considered to be the non-formal sector. You know, they're not, they're working on the streets. They're working in the fields. And there's no protection for those children. So one of the things that we're trying to do in the child-to-child program is to deal with what we call children in difficult circumstances. Well, in a culture of poverty such as Nicaragua, it's pretty hard to figure out who are the kids that are not in difficult circumstances. But we've tried to determine certain target populations for the work that we're doing. And so we are working at the present time in rural areas and in urban areas. And in the urban areas, we're working in the neighborhoods where there are more problems, where there's the most severe poverty. There are about 130 squatters settlements that have sprouted up in the last 2 years in Managua. Squatter settlements. And so we're working in communities, in neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods, where these squatter settlements are. They have no water, they have no life, they have no public services of any kind. And because they're squatters, you know, what they want to do is get them out of it. They don't want them to be there, but they're there, and it's a fact. And most of them are people who come from rural areas, people who came in fleeing from the war, or came in hoping that the new government would help to provide housing and services for them, because there were lots of promises made. So we have these children that are in these settlements. A lot of these children are children who work on the streets. Others are children who, in some way or other, turn into street children. They may live in their home, but they pass all the time on the street. Or they may just go and live in the streets. Now, it's it's very hard for me to explain this, but if you were in Nicaragua, you know that when you went there, there weren't children on the streets, or there were very few children on the streets, because there were programs. There were the quinchos, which is a special program for kids that were abandoned, and those programs have lost all their funding. So that's where they are. They're out there. And we have a situation where almost every major street corner cross-section has kids selling things. And you can buy almost anything from TV antennas to food on those street corners. And that's where you see a lot of these kids. Then we have other children. We have children who are disabled. And there's a special program for children who are disabled called Los Pipitos. And in Los Pipitos, these are children with Down syndrome or other disabilities. They have a program called the Brothers and Sisters. And so we're working with the Brothers and Sisters of Disabled Children in the Child program. And then we work in just poor neighborhoods. Poor neighborhoods along the lakefront in Managua, which is a very difficult area to work in because it's very hard to do community organization there. So what we've tried to do is not work with individual groups of kids, but to try to find ways that we can do our sessions together. So we have the promoters in the different groups, and the promoters come together and they plan activities. And then they go back and they organize these activities with the kids in their groups. And every so often, every two or three months or so, all the kids come together and share what they've been doing in their particular neighborhoods. And you get a lot of cross-fertilization that way. And you get a lot of ideas from one group to the other. And because the groups are really very, very different in the kinds of situations they might be living in or working in, when they come together, there's this idea of how can we solve the problems of our young people in our communities. And a very interesting kind of thing is happening. Most of the time when we've worked on this program in the past, we've been dealing with problems related to sanitation or the diarrhea, as I mentioned, and introducing a whole lot of idea of how to work and how to identify very early on respiratory distress. And we've worked with accidents. And just about 4 months ago, we began to get little murmurings from here and there. We have a situation in Nicaragua, and I think that it's found in other poor countries, but just speaking from our situation at the present time, we have a post-war stress syndrome that's happening, you know? And we have a lot of violence. And there's a lot of violence against women and much violence against children. And what we discovered is that in our groups, the kids began to talk about what could they do about violence against children. Well, this isn't in our regular our regular curriculums for this kind of methodology. This is something new, but it's a challenge for us. And we have to be creative and think of how can we work around this situation. And so the kids have come together, some of the teenagers, and talked about how can we help young children know and understand what's happening in their homes and in the communities, and especially the kids on the street. How can young kids keep from having something happen to them, violence against them? And they've taken specific examples of things that have been in the press. We had a child who was decapitated, and I haven't been able to find out who this child is, and so there was a lot of press, very yellow press, given to the whole thing. And the kids started discussing what they could do. Now, what these young people do with their groups is they do a lot of role play. And they do a lot of games, as I mentioned before. They make up poetry, they make up songs, they find ways of getting messages across. And we knew that they were working on this in some of the communities. But recently, when we celebrated our 9th anniversary of the organization that I direct, we decided that this year we would make our 9th anniversary a big party for a lot of these kids that we work with. And we would dedicate our 9th anniversary to children, and we asked them to come. And invited different children and from the groups that we're working with. And they each had to present something. And that day that we had the presentation, there were children from all over the country, from different kinds of situations and different kinds of communities, and the kids in this particularly difficult area of Manawa did a presentation. They did a little sociodrama, a drama about a child who goes off to work in the streets in the morning and how she's followed by somebody and the person starts trying to molest her, you know, and what she does and how she gets out of that situation. And then they discuss it. They don't just, it's just not a play. You know, a sociodrama is just not a play. It's something to provoke discussion. And so there was a discussion about this, and here we have these children from all different areas. So that kind of cross-fertilization between the one group that has developed something around this problem and the other groups is really very important. Well, we try to have encounters of children who are working on the child methodology about every 2 to 3 months. And at the end of last year, and again this November, we'll have a nationwide child-to-child encounter. And at that time, children from different areas of the country will come in and share what they've been doing during the last year, talk about how they could do this better, how they can spread this. We had, on International Children's Day, which is the 1st of June, there was a parade. Some of the children organized parade. And the children in the child-to-child programs, independently of us, decided that they would also march in the parade. And 3 different groups from 3 different neighborhoods came. And we felt that this was really a wonderful thing because we didn't organize it. It wasn't dependent upon somebody from outside telling these kids what to do. They decided that there's a movement that they're starting. It's a child-to-child movement, and that they were going to do something with this. Now, how many of you here were Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts or Brownie Scouts or whatever? Huh? Well, almost all of us, right? And we know how important that our scouting was to us. And I think, in a way, that what we're trying to do with the child-to-child work in Nicaragua, when I start thinking back and what can I connect it to something that we did, well then I think maybe this is it. Maybe what we learned through our scouting experience with older scouts, with the Girl Scouts helping the Brownie Scouts, isn't that what we did? Maybe that is something similar to what is happening at the present time. I mean, we started this because we're concerned about the health of communities and especially the health of children. But what I see happening is that children are taking hold of this and it's becoming something important for them. And I think that the most important thing that we can do as people who work with this methodology is to recognize, first of all, the capacities of the kids and that we can't manipulate them, that we have to give them the freedom so that they can develop these programs. Because I really feel like the kind of decision making that goes on with these kids working together in their communities and this kind of recognition of community responsibilities, what we're really doing is building, we're helping to develop citizens. Mm-hmm. Because these kids are learning now a lot about their communities that perhaps they wouldn't have learned about or thought about if they were in this program. And the other thing is that they're discovering ways, alternatives to deal with problems in their communities. And many of us who are working in countries where structural adjustment programs are affecting government programs and are cutting out almost all the social services and education and health, and this is happening all over the world, and I venture to say it's happening here. I heard somebody last week saying that they still didn't have their budget for November for the school system in one of the school districts in California. Well, why is that? I mean, you're having your budgets cut back here in this country as well, but it's much more drastic in the third world countries. And I think that we can't expect or even make demands on governments in third world countries because the governments are so tied up into this international banking system. So our only possibility for the future of our communities is grassroots development. Mm-hmm. I really feel that this is true. I see somebody there nodding their head. You must agree with me. So we have to look for grassroots solutions. We have to look for local solutions to local problems. And if we begin by working with these young people at this time, these are going to be the citizens of the future. If they've survived the first 5 years, the probability is that they're going to survive for a lot longer. No, they didn't die in the first 5 years. It's survival of the fittest, and they're going to go on. And that means that they're going to be the leaders and the community of tomorrow. And so we feel that very strongly that this kind of work that we can do with these young people today will help build better local communities for tomorrow. And so while it may be hard for us to bring about the social change that took place, you know, go back to what we had 5-6 years ago, that's not possible because the powers that be won't let that happen. You see, if the Sandinistas had won the election in Nicaragua, we would still be at war. And so now we don't have a military war going on in Central America, in Nicaragua. We still have military wars going on in Guatemala. But we have a situation where it's almost an economic kind of war. No? And it's the huge corporations and the establishment that is not going to let us have grandiose structural change. But where are we going to have to do it then? We're going to have to do it in our local communities. And we really feel, especially those of us who have been a long time in these countries, that the future is in our young people. And yes, we have to continue to work with older people, but it's much easier to bring about a change in habits, to help have young people learn when they're very young about the ways that they can make their communities and their homes safer, how they can save the lives of their young children. You know? And through that experience, I think we will be building a movement for citizens in the future that will make our communities at the local level healthier. At least that's what we hope.
What kind of response are you getting from the adults in terms of helping the program and response to the program? You mentioned a little bit about some opposition, but in general, how much are you seeing in terms of?
One of the problems that we're having this year is the demand for us to help people develop local programs and child to child is greater than we can even meet. I mean, we have only so many people who are working with us. There's so much that we can do in 1 year's time. So what we have begun to do is have people who've been involved in this program for some time help other communities get going on it. And our organization is an organization that works to be a multiplier in any case. But I think the fact that this is growing and more people want to become involved in it is a very good sign.
Adults in the community?
Well, adults who see that this kind of program has some future in their community, because this isn't an adult-directed program, it's a child-directed program. And it, in the measure...
But it's adults setting it up right now.
Well, that's not true. I mean, the adults started it, but we started it with young people. But this whole business of violence against young children didn't come from us. That was the point I was trying to make.
Yeah, right. And
that to me is a sign that the kids are learning to make decisions for themselves. And yes, there needs to be guidance. We needed guidance when we were scouts too. But our scout leaders weren't supposed to tell us everything we were supposed to do. They were supposed to help us. You've just been hiking with those young people. You weren't telling them everything that they were supposed to do. They were learning from that experience. Isn't that so? And then they can help other people do that in the future. I mean, we try to help build skills in the children. And the problem with so many adults is that we want to keep telling everybody what to do. You know? I mean, we do that in our homes and our families. We do that in our workplace. And that's what our foreign policy is, telling everybody in the world what they should do.
So you're finding an opposition from the adults to that?
No, I'm not finding too much opposition, but I think because it's coming up from the grassroots and from the kids, that's why we haven't had opposition. It's not threatening to the power structure, because they'll say, well, that's just a bunch of kids. But watch out for those kids when they get a little older, you know? And kids are talking about what our rights are. There is a convention of the rights of the child, no? And these kids are learning what that convention means, and they've made up songs about it. They have a whole series of songs about the rights of children. And they sing those songs, and they teach them to other kids, and they talk about what does this mean, no? And in Nicaragua, the kids, Nicaraguans are all poets, no? And so poetry is really very important in the culture, and a lot of this is done through poetry, through games, through drama. No. Cultural expressions that are familiar to people, and that people listen to. See, you're bombarded here with advertisements, and you notice how the kids learn all the advertisements? I mean, thank God there's no television here, or maybe there is, I just don't know. But anyway, I feel that there's such a bombardment with everything, but you know how kids pick up, and adults as well, on the advertisements and start repeating the advertisements. Well, we figured the same thing can be done, you know, with our songs that have a message that's a healthy message. So there hasn't really been opposition for this kind of work.
Have you
I mean, if they see
support?
This as a big
fight. Have you found a lot of support then, too, or is it just kind of...
Well, no. The interesting thing is that there is support from organizations like Save the Children. Here in the United States, there's Save the Children. They're not working in Nicaragua. A lot of that, because there was a boycott, you know, and then a lot of U.S. organizations weren't active in Nicaragua. But Red Barna, which is Norwegian, is working in Nicaragua, and they get support for our program.
I guess what's more meaning on the grassroots level, the adults of these kids, and are you getting support from them as a result of what they're doing?
Yes.
Things like that.
Yes. A lot of the changes that have to take place in communities involve adults. I mean, if we talk about building latrines, we don't expect all little kids to go off. They work with people in their families. The parents, or the older people in the families, are learning from the younger kids.
It seems like you're really empowering the children, which I think is really terrific, and you're taking it and running it. But at the level where they're being taught how to be better caregivers for the siblings, someone's teaching them a very important parental role, which they're already doing a lot of that role anyway, so I think that's great. But is it stressful for them to sort of have this knowledge and so they feel the responsibility to carry that out, to go home and make these solutions when they see their younger siblings having diarrhea? Is that ever expressed? Is that difficult for them?
I suppose that in some cases it is. But because we work with groups and not just individuals, there's that support across the group. You know? And, you know, the kids support one another. And then there are adults around who are supportive of this. There are teachers that see this as a really important way of looking at the work with children. Health workers have become involved much more than they were in the past. The interesting thing for me is that about the first time I did anything with a child to child in Nicaragua was in 1981. And that was shortly before I began to work with the Ministry of Health. And this is in the Sandinista time. And one of the things that I wanted to try to do when I saw that it was working in several scattered communities was that this become a program that the Sandinista government would be involved in. And I could never get anybody to do it. And now we don't have a progressive government. We don't have the support that we need in terms of the ministries. And we have a whole group of people really willing to take it and run with it. And, you know, that's one of the contradictions that one finds in this business.
This may seem obvious, but a family has a small child, has no siblings. Does that child, is there a kind of a neighborhood grouping which works together with those kids so they're looking after all, other than their own siblings? Mm-hmm.
I just saw that we're way over time. I'm sorry. But what we try to do is we have this team. This is a team of these young people, you know, from about 10 to 13 years of age. And those teams go out and they work with groups of children. So there's one team may have four or five groups of kids they're working with. So these are the promoters for the children in these groups, and then these children.